talking to Connie. The artist saw me first and said,
"You washed off your face."
"Yes, ma'am. I liked it so much I would have worn it for days, except when I left the fairground for a while. It kind of freaked out people."
"Want me to paint you again?"
"Thank you, no. I need to talk to the chief here." She looked at my left hand.
"Are you all right?"
I realized the wound had opened. Blood slowly soaked through the thickness of gauze I'd taped over it. "Nothing serious," I assured her. "Just an accident with a stapler."
"I wish my brother was here," Connie said. "You need an Ethan on your side."
Evidently she didn't buy the stapler story. To give the chief and me privacy, she went to her mother's station to watch as the third bird woman's face was completed to perfection. I expect that Wyatt Porter could maintain his cool through a volcanic eruption, although on this occasion he appeared undeniably harried. With his bloodhound jowls and his bagged, heavy-lidded eyes, he made people think of their favorite uncle. If you were perceptive, however, you saw a little bit of a Robert Mitchum look to him, and you knew that the avuncular face disguised a whip-smart, no-nonsense, hard-assed officer of the law. Now he had more of a Mitchum look than ever. As if anyone gave him the slightest reason to bust their chops, he would keep on punching, even after he'd broken all his knuckles. He said,
"I told you 10 or 12,000 on the fairground, but now we have the gate count, and it's over 15,000. 6 of my guys, plus 9 state police, are walking the midway, looking for something suspicious. All in plain clothes, so they won't spook these crazy bastards into pushing the button early. 15 guys in a crowd of 15,000. With no idea what suspicious looks like in this case."
"Earlier on the phone, sir, you said Wolfgang bought a couple of concessions. Maybe that's where it'll all go down." Chief Porter shook his head.
"That would be too easy. According to Lionel Sombra, Wolfgang, his real name was Woodrow Creel, hired longtime carnies to work his places, people that have been with Sombra Brothers in one role or another for 15, 20 years and more. Anyway, using the murder investigation as an excuse, about 2 hours ago, we closed both concessions for the night, sent the workers away. Left my guys, Taylor Pipes and Nick Corker, guarding both locations. It didn't seem to alarm these cultists, didn't cause them to pull the trigger."
He indicated my bandaged hand, which I held down at my side, letting it drip.
"That doesn't look good, son."
"It looks bad, but it doesn't hurt," I lied. As Chief Porter watched fairgoers streaming past the open front of the Face-It tent, a sea of humanity in its infinite variety, he said,
"Doesn't seem right that these lunatics should look like anyone else. Can't you do your magnetism thing and draw a couple of them to you?"
"Don't have a name. Don't have a face. Don't have anything to focus on, sir. What about the other two who were executed in that motorhome, Jonathan and Celine? Do you know anything about them?"
"Real names were Jeremy and Sybil von Witzelben. Husband and wife, both of them doctors of some kind."
The 100 different tunes issuing from attractions up and down the long midway had usually before seemed more festive than not. Even if the many-braided melodies were to the ear, what a line of prose would be to the eye of a dyslexic reader. But now the music began to slide slowly into a sour disharmony.
"Those two," the chief continued, "had more stamps in their passports than a coyote has fleas. Spent most of the last year down in Venezuela, which is a sewer these days. Food shortages, toilet paper rationing, runaway inflation, death squads. Who in his right mind would want to spend a year there?"
"Doctors of what?"
"We're researching that. I'm waiting for a call."
We were standing near the front of the tent, and as we looked out at the midway, the razzle-dazzle of carnival lights seemed to be brighter and more frantic than before. The blinkers blinked faster. The pulsers pulsed faster. Waves of color chased one another faster, faster through the various fiber-optic designs. Indicating the people on the concourse, the chief sounded as if frustration was about to make him scream.
"Point me to one of those hateful bastards, Adi. You see things I can't. You always have. See something for me. I really need you to see something for me, son."
My mind was still awash with the flood dream that evidently wasn't about a flood. The coyotes that had been something more than coyotes. The sandpiper that had flown from Tim's hand and vanished from our perspective, only to come into view to people farther up the beach. The safe house that had appeared to be so Victorian, but had been woven through with hidden high-tech defenses. The angelic face of the cult girl in Lauren's house, and the vicious face of the same girl gone poltergeist. As the chief's cell phone rang and he answered it, I tried to sweep clean the junk shop that was my mind, and began to study the people on the concourse, mere feet away. He was right. I had always seen things he couldn't. Things that no one else could see. Why not here? Why not now, when it mattered so very much and so urgently? He had several short questions for his caller, and was terminating the call just as I saw two men ambling by, as if they had never known a care in their entire lives, eating ice cream bars dipped in chocolate and served on sticks, chatting and laughing and enjoying the flash and bustle of the carnival. They were in their 20s. Looked like surfer dudes from out of town. Blonde and tanned and fit. Dressed in jeans and t-shirts. One of them had a red and black tattoo that began at his wrist and wound up his right arm, where it disappeared under the sleeve of his t-shirt. It was not an ordinary tattoo of a dragon or a snake or a mermaid, but a series of hieroglyphics. A statement of some kind, maybe a scrap of satanic prayer. Or a defiant pledge, spelled in the singular symbols of the same pictographic language that I'd seen on the Covens estate in Nevada, that had been painted on the tailgate of the Cadillac Escalade that had tried to run me down during my motorcycle trip to Pico Mundo. "Sir," I said, and by my tone alerted him. "See the surfer guys eating ice cream? The one with the tattoo, he's one of them. Which means the guy with him must be one of them, too." "You're sure?" "Yes." Looking away from the cultists, lest they notice his interest and take flight, Chief Porter unclipped a walkie-talkie from his belt. It was the size of a cell phone. He pressed send and held it down while he talked. To the 15 plainclothes officers walking the midway, he said, "Contact, outside the face-it tent." He described the two men. "Converge if you're nearby." One designated respondent said, 10-4, to confirm that the message had been received. "If they go in an attraction, off the concourse, maybe we can take them quietly, squeeze them hard for information." 10-4. "That phone call," the chief said to me, "was a prelim report on Jeremy and Sybil von Witzelben."
The ice cream eaters had stopped to watch people playing a dart game involving a spinning wheel, an array of balloons, and a barker who distracted the players with amusing patter.
"The von Witzelbens were both microbiologists. She was also an epidemiologist, a specialist in epidemic diseases. He had an advanced degree in virology."
What were they up to in Venezuela? I wondered. Having lost interest in the dart game, the ice cream eaters meandered east along the concourse. The chief said,
"They were doing something that could be done only where the government, courts, and cops are all hugely corrupt."
The ice cream eaters began to melt into the crowd.
"Damn. Where are my guys? Gotta keep those two in sight till I can turn them over to plainclothes."
"I'll do it, sir."
"You don't have one of these," he said, indicating the walkie-talkie, "and you can't have mine."
As he hurried from the tent to trail the ice cream eaters at a distance, all the thoughts and memories ricocheting through my head at last coalesced. Standing at the sink in the half-bathroom at Lauren Ainsworth's house, watching the rushing water pour over the wound in my hand. The water too hot, exacerbating the pain, but I don't cool it down because I'm gripped by a sense of a pending revelation related to the water, and the blood, and the pain. Aware that there is something I know but do not know I know. Something about blood and terrible pain and water. The plump cashier with the auburn hair saying, "You're the one tonight, honey, you're the one tonight." Gypsy mummy in the four blank cards suggesting no future, no future at all. Four when one would have conveyed the message. Perhaps the one thing I knew about the true and hidden nature of the world was that there were no coincidences. The Cadillac Escalade burning at the bottom of the desert arroyo.
on the phone with Chief Porter while he's telling me about Wolfgang and Jonathan and Celine, now known to be Woodrow and Jeremy and Sybil, and he says one or all three look to have been junkies, hypodermic needles, ampules of drugs. Being chased through the pitch-black department store, relying on my special guide dog, my psychic magnetism. Eye to eye with mugs. Microbiologists. Epidemiology, virology. 4 blank cards, 4 predictions of death. The 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. Pestilence, war, famine, and death. But no Bodox. Why no Bodox if mass murder is about to happen? The dying girl in the closet saying, "You a dog. Oh yeah, you a dog." Blood and terrible pain and water. Blind in the death black department store, led by my faithful guide dog, good old psychic magnetism. Led to the man-made cave of suburban bats. A minimum of 30% of any colony of bats is infected with rabies. The auburn-haired woman in ticket booth number 4, reading Ozzie Boone's The Last Good Bite, a novel in which death by bats was the red herring. There are no coincidences. The dying girl saying, "Hey, dog, you got papers." Papers meaning proof of vaccination. Hypodermic needles, ampules of some drug. No, ampules of a vaccine. Blood and terrible pain and water. Hydrophobia. Another name for rabies, hydrophobia. More facts courtesy of Ozzie Boone. The victim of rabies suffers intense thirst, but any attempt to drink induces violent, agonizing spasms of the throat, hence the word hydrophobia, fear of water. Eye and facial muscles become paralyzed. Infected dogs foam at the mouth, are wild with rage and quick to bite. Venezuela, a dictatorship, virtually a terrorist state. The first 2 of the 4 horsemen, pestilence and war. Pestilence is a weapon in the silent war that is part of the true and hidden nature of the world. Weaponized rabies. The cultists vaccinated, the rest of us not. No Bodox because tonight involves only a quiet infection of thousands. No one aware. And the dying doesn't start for days. The dying and the violence. People raging like rabid dogs, which is when the Bodox would show up in legions. The sandpiper winging through the air, vanishing to one observer, but visible to others. To infect the thousands on the midway, the weaponized rabies would have to be airborne, invisible to those who breathed it in, its presence known only to the vaccinated cultists. The C4 was a distraction. The dam had never been a target. Nothing had been what it appeared to be. Or rather, everything had been more than it appeared to be. 15,000 infected. And then how many would they infect before their symptoms became apparent? This wasn't only about Pico Mundo. The secret war fought all around us by armies little noticed was about to escalate. "Norman, are you all right?" I turned to Connie, who had put a hand on my shoulder. My horror must have been evident, because she flinched as if something about my face, my eyes, frightened her.
"No, you're not all right, are you?"
"The man, Wolfgang Schmidt," I said. "Did you know him?"
"Did I know him? Has something happened to him?"
News of the 3 brutal murders in the Kearney Park had not spread to every corner of the Midway in the 3 hours since they occurred, probably because Wyatt Porter had done his best to keep a lid on it. "Do you know him?" I asked.
"I know who he is, but I don't know him."
"He bought 2 concessions.
Some say he never was from a Kearney family. Norman, your hand needs medical attention."
"What concessions did he buy?"
"They belong to Solly Nichols. Solly got lung cancer, and it went fast with him. His kids didn't want a carnival life, so he took the best offer. Schmidt overpaid."
"Which concessions, Connie?"
"The duck chute and the funhouse."
In my mind's eye, I saw the facade of the funhouse. The giant dimensional sculpture of an ogre's face, 20 feet from chin to crown, almost as wide. detailed and scary, but hokey at the same time, its crazed eyes rolling in its socket. Periodically a growl issued from its open mouth, a growl and a strong blast of compressed air that traveled 20 feet into the promenade, mussing patrons' hair and startling them. I stepped out of the tent, not quite into the throng, scanning the crowd for Chief Porter. The pumping calliope, the 100 other musics, the laughter and screams of the marks on the thrill rides, the smells and the dazzling lights made me a little dizzy. I could not see the chief. He'd follow the ice cream eaters out of sight. Behind me, Connie said,
"Norman, what's wrong?"
The funhouse was east along this leg of the concourse. I glanced at my wristwatch. 11 o'clock.
"Norman, your hand!"
45 minutes. Unless someone got nervous for whatever reason and pulled the trigger sooner. I pressed forward through the resisting crowd, east, toward the funhouse. 50. The midway crowd was bigger than a crowd, a throng, bigger than a throng, a multitude, the ceaseless press and crush of human flesh. People of all kinds and ages, senior citizens with canes and hearing aids and bifocals, teenagers in groups, dressed and accessorized in rebellion and yet dressed alike, some intent on texting or playing games on their phones, even with the riotous carnival clamoring for their attention and their dollars all around them. Children eating cotton candy and ice cream and popcorn. Children who should have been home in bed but were here with their parents. Children with painted faces, none of them painted like death, yet each of them a dead child walking, if the cult succeeded. Short men with tall women, fat women with skinny men, the gay, the straight, and the confused, Democrats and Republicans and those who, if asked, would shout neither, the rich and the poor, all races, all creeds, all targets for those who did not believe that life was precious. By the time I reached the funhouse, I'd still not seen Chief Porter or the two men he was tailing. In the giant face of the ogre, the eyes were not rolling as before, but were fixed straight ahead. The sculpted beast no longer issued threatening roars accompanied by great blasts of breath. The eerie music had been silenced. The lights that previously pulsed and flashed were dark now. A sign, hanging from a cord strung between two stanchions on the entrance ramp, simply declared, "Closed." I didn't think it wise to enter the attraction by way of the ramp, in plain view of everyone on the concourse. Some people might recognize me, and a few of them might be cult members. In truth, I assumed that it wouldn't be wise to enter the funhouse by any means whatsoever, but I was exhausted and bleeding and terrified. It wasn't possible for me to buy an ice cream and go to the carousel instead, and ride around on one of the swan benches provided among the horses for those who were in no condition to climb into the saddle and hold onto a brass pole. Acting as if I was a person of authority in the Sombra Brothers operation, with my bleeding left hand thrust under my sport coat as if soothing an acidic stomach or doing a Napoleon imitation, I left the concourse. I walked between the funhouse and the Wall of Death, which featured performances by a motorcycle daredevil riding at high speed, parallel to the ground, around the wall of a circular arena about 15 feet deep, doing tricks, while the patrons on tiered bleachers looked down on him, waiting for something to go wrong that would turn him into Jell-O in a costume. They were between shows, but gasoline fumes lingered from the previous one. Most of the carnival's attractions were intense, but the funhouse had board walls with a canvas roof. They had probably put it up and torn it down 1,000 times without incident, but I doubted that there was a structural engineer in the world who, upon close inspection of the place, wouldn't have the vapors. Images of ghosts, vampires, and werewolves covered the side wall, but they were no more scary than Mickey Mouse. At the back of the structure, a loosely fitted wooden door was labeled, "Keep Out, Employees Only." Although few marks ever ventured behind the attractions, the former owner, Solly Nichols, evidently believed in consistency of presentation. The words on the door looked as if they had been written by the finger of a skeleton, using blood for paint. I thought the door would be locked, but it wasn't. I couldn't decide if that was a good or bad thing. When I stepped inside, I found myself in a small vestibule with a 10-foot ladder nailed to the wall in front of me. 4 steps to my left, 4 to my right. Each set of steps led to a door. I tried the door on the left. It opened awkwardly outward, because above it, on the inner side, hung a lighted emergency exit sign. Beyond lay a narrow corridor in which the walls, floor, and ceiling were painted flat black. This funhouse was a walk-through, rather than a ride-through palace of thrills and chills, a black maze in which monsters pop from walls or drop from ceilings, triggered by motion detectors. Ordinarily, the maze would be all but pitch black, but at the moment a string of work lights revealed the way. Hanging overhead were rubber spiders the size of poodles, vaguely luminescent. I could hear the noises of the carnival and the boisterous crowd, but no sound that seemed to come from within the funhouse. I tried the door on the right and found the same situation, although instead of spiders, they were shrunken heads. Chief Porter had said that he'd assigned Taylor Pipes and Nick Corker to keep watch of the 2 attractions. I knew them both, nice guys. I almost called out, but then decided to keep silent. In my mind's eye, I summoned Taylor's and Nick's faces. I concentrated on their names, and psychic magnetism drew me to the ladder. I needed both hands, and the pain in my left made an ordeal of ascension. I left a slick of blood on the rungs, which worried me, not because I might be losing a critical amount of it, which I wasn't, but because I was trying to be quiet and was pretty much succeeding, but the blood left a trail that could be noticed and followed. 10 feet above the floor of the vestibule, the ladder brought me to an opening about 4 feet wide and a little over 6 high. Rungs in the walls provided grips to swing safely off the ladder and onto my feet. The walls were painted light gray there, and a string of small work lights ran end to end. No rubber spiders or shrunken heads or other claptrap cluttered the space. I assumed that the maze lay under me, and that this passageway allowed an employee to travel from one end of the funhouse to the other without encountering customers. I stood listening, but, as far as I could tell, still heard no sound that originated within those walls. All the noise filtering in from the carnival, however, could surely mask the scrapes and clicks and creaks of anyone who might be moving as cautiously through the structure as I was. The gray corridor ended in another ladder that led down a 4-foot square shaft. Although my left hand wasn't growing numb and the pain remained as bad as ever, it became stiffer by the minute and less useful to me. As much as possible, I tried to grip it with just my fingers, rather than wrap the skewered palm around the rungs, but the descent became a sweat-inducing, heart-knocking, gruesome little journey. At the bottom waited another door. When I opened it, I found Taylor Pipe's body. 51. He'd been shot once in the back. There wasn't much blood because the round had gone through his heart, stopping it in an instant. He hadn't drawn his weapon. Taylor Pipes had been smart and quick, not a guy who allowed himself to be shot from behind. The room in which he'd met his end measured perhaps 10 feet from the door by which I'd entered to the front wall of the funhouse, maybe 25 feet from side to side. I was behind the head of the ogre, looking at a reverse mold of the beastly face. From the midway, you couldn't discern that it had been cast in 2 pieces, but from this perspective, the joining bolts in the center seam were evident. The backs of the eyeballs, which rolled ominously when the face came to life, were maybe 6 feet above me, and the mouth just above floor level. In addition to the door beyond which lay the ladder to the high gray corridor, 4 other doors offered choices, a pair that flanked the first, and 1 at each end of the space. Between the doors were trick mirrors. In this one, I swelled fat. In the next, I shrank thin as a pencil. Here, I stood with a huge head and diminutive body. There, I had an immense body and a head no bigger than a baseball.
In another, my body and head were sinuous, twisting, as if I were a vaporous genie writhing out of a well-rubbed lamp. In every mirror, I bled from my left hand, and in every mirror, I held the Glock in my right. I assumed the four doors through which I had not entered all led to different sections of the maze, and that patrons returned more than once to this space behind the ogre's head as they tried to find their way out. The cultist who had taken Taylor by surprise might have left the funhouse for some reason, or he might still be lurking elsewhere within it. In either case, there were five doors by which he could return at any moment. Turning from the last mirror, I saw what had been so important to me in the dream of the amaranth, what I had thought of as the urn, a stainless steel cylinder about half again as tall and half again as wide as a carton of milk. The object stood beside a heavy-duty electric air compressor and associated equipment that, even to a mechanical ignoramus like me, couldn't be mistaken for anything other than the source of the ogre's blasts of breath that accompanied his roars of rage. A 4-inch diameter tube led from the compressor to the monster's mouth. The urn could be nothing else than a container of the weaponized rabies virus, suspended in some medium that would efficiently convey it into the ogre's exhalations, whereupon it would be spewed with force across the crowded concourse, through the happy, bustling crowd, toward the many rides and the other attractions in the center of the midway. The medium would be odorless and tasteless, but might appear as a faint mist. Because Ozzie Boone had written a novel about a killer virus, and because he was incapable of withholding from his friends the numerous fascinating details of the research he did for a novel, I knew a few things about viruses, just as I knew more than I ever wanted to know about bats, liver flukes, the incidence of psychopathic tendencies in clowns, and the capacity of hogs to be trained to kill. Bacteria were exceedingly small creatures, but viruses were smaller still. Big viruses were 1/5 the size of the average bacterium, but the vast majority of them were orders of magnitude smaller. The flu virus measured 80/1000ths of a millionth of a meter in diameter. Viruses were so tiny they couldn't be seen with ordinary microscopes. Their structure wasn't known until the invention of the electron microscope in 1933. Billions of viruses could fit into one drop of water. Viruses have none of our five senses, but they have one sense, the only one they need, an unexplained ability to detect the chemical composition of the cell surface of whichever species makes the best hosts for them. Detecting it, they are drawn to it. You might say that viruses have one sense, and that it is pretty much the same one that I call psychic magnetism. For those of you who don't believe the world is a mysterious and deeply layered place, brood on that a while. The urn could hold megatrillions of the weaponized rabies virus, enough perhaps to infect the entire population of the planet. Pico Mundo might be the locus from which a plague spread across several counties in California and Nevada before being contained, or across the nation, or across the world. From the top of that shiny cylinder of death sprouted a nozzle encircled by what appeared to be a rotating petcock currently in the closed position. A rubber tube connected the nozzle to a hole that had been drilled in the 4-inch diameter outfeed pipe through which the compressor released jets of the ogre's breath into the world beyond. I knelt beside the cylinder and was about to pluck that tube from the nozzle when the door at the west end of the room flew open and a little man appeared there. Lou Donatella wasn't dressed as a bear cub this time, but pretty much like me, except that he had the good taste not to wear a powder blue sport coat. Holding the pistol in a two-hand grip, he squeezed off three shots, killing the man behind me, who I had not heard come out of one of the other doors. More often than I could count in my eventful life, I'd been taken by surprise, but never more so than by Lou's in-the-nick-of-time arrival. After our brief encounter in the Kearney campground, he had decided to ally himself with me.
Our eyes met and shared amazement and astonishment, which were not the same thing, which I knew to be true because Ozzie Boone had explained the difference to me. When he spoke, Lou revealed that he possessed psychic abilities, as I had thought he might.
I foresaw this much, but not what comes next.
I tore the rubber tube from the urn, just as one of the mirrors, which proved to be a hidden door, flew open like the lid of a jack-in-the-box, and a cultist shot me. Lou shot the cultist, and in turn the cultist shot Lou dead. Although I'd taken a bullet in the right side of my chest and could not get my breath, I had the strength and balance to shoot the cultist, finishing the job that my short comrade had started. Aside from dying, there was nothing left for me to do but take the stainless steel cylinder, the urn, and the amaranth dream, where the cultist couldn't get their murderous hands on it, to Chief Wyatt Porter, who would know what to do, who always knew what to do, who was one of the two surrogate fathers who had always been there for me, when my real father could not be bothered. 52. Leaving the funhouse by the door through which Lou Donatella had entered to save me, I turned right, because to turn left would be to go into the maze. A short passageway brought me to the ramp that served as the public entrance. Having dropped my pistol to be able to hold the cylinder of weaponized rabies with both arms, I staggered down the ramp, sidled past the stanchions that supported the closed sign, and turned left into surging multitudes. I shouted at people to get out of my way, declared that I was wounded and dying, and they took me seriously when they noticed all the blood. They took me even more seriously when I shouted that I was diseased and dying, which was a bald-faced lie, but in crisis you say what you have to say and worry later about whether you screwed up or not. The people who were attracted by the novelty of seeing a man die from a gunshot were repelled by the prospect of contracting the disease with which I might be infected. At that moment, I saw something that I first thought must be a hallucination, a consequence of blood loss and shock. Among the people in the crowd, there were some into whom I could look, as if I had X-ray vision, though it was only their hearts that were visible to me, hearts not red, but black. Hearts not of muscle, but of metal, cardiac machines ticking and thumping and glistening with oil. I'm sure that if autopsied, their hearts would have looked unremarkable. What I saw was the hidden truth of them. From each of those dark and seemingly robotic hearts, a black filament, an umbilical invisible to ordinary eyes, snaked away into the carnival. Snaked away through the whirling amusements and the blinking lights, as if to some puppeteer in concealment. Somehow I knew that not all of them were cultists, that many of them did evil to their fellow man without the need of an organization to support them. When I looked up into their faces, I saw in every case what they did not see in their mirrors, eyes that were like pools of oil without color. And if they didn't know me for who and what I was, an entity of terrible power looked through their eyes from its remote lair and knew me, and caused them, one after another, to smile in pleasure at the sight of my suffering. I turned my eyes from them and did not look again. In this world, evil works through countless surrogates. Its name is Legion. But good works through surrogates as well, and they are legion too. The rest of my time in the Midway ticked away pretty much as in the dream of the amaranth that I have already recounted. Somehow I found the strength to lumber forward while the carnival around me blurred and became a place without detail, where those luminous smears of red and blue and gold and white and green whirled and pulsed, swooped toward me and soared, as if they were shapeless birds of light. Screams and panic shouting, tortured and shrill music. I see no need to describe the pandemonium again.
Pain?
Oh, yes. Devastating pain. Like nothing I'd ever known before. And a frightening sense of walking a high wire. Of falling for a moment, but then finding myself on the wire again. Falling into a black void, but then rebounding from it once more. Blossom Rosedale appeared, as she had in the dream, and helped me to stay on my feet. I'd never seen the happy monster cry before, and I told her not to weep now, told her that I knew to what I was coming, that I had been coming to it for almost 2 years, and that whatever the place might prove to be, I was not afraid. If I didn't say all that, I thought I did, but she continued to cry as she helped me along. I didn't see the cultist behind us, the last assassin, who would have shot me and no doubt Blossom too. Chief Wyatt Porter, who had always been there when I needed him, was there again. He loomed as in the dream, the muzzle of his service pistol swelling until it looked like the mouth of a cannon. He shot the lunatic before the lunatic could shoot us. Just like the transition in the dream, I found myself lying on a hard surface, but unlike in the dream, I knew that I rested on the table where Connie, sister to Ethan, kept her array of paints and brushes and sponges in the face-it tent. She'd swept all of her things to the floor with one arm, and they'd placed me upon the table to await the paramedics, who were already racing to the scene. All the noise of the carnival had faded, and there were only soft voices, murmuring and weeping, when no weeping was necessary. The three lovely black girls stood by me, looking down with solemn brown eyes, their faces painted with white and gold feathers, their hands upon my arms, my brow, as if to hold me to the world of the living. Terry Stambaugh was there too, for she'd been at the carnival that night. Terry and Blossom Rosedale, as in the dream. Someone said that everyone should stay back so as not to stress me, but I said no. I said I wanted to see them all. To see people. I wanted to see not just the people I loved and the people I knew, but also the people I didn't know. I wanted to see people, because people had been my life, the good and bad, but always so many more good people than bad. They had been my life, and I did not want to die without the faces of people as the last thing I saw of that beautiful and mysterious world. In the dream, Wyatt Porter had not been by the table on which I was lying, but he appeared there in the fulfillment of the dream, as did Edie Fisher, and Connie, and Connie's mother. And I loved them all, those I knew and those I didn't. I think the last thing I said was, "Where is Anna Maria?" As in the dream, I closed my eyes and opened them and found myself alone. I seemed to be paralyzed, couldn't move a finger. Panic took me for a moment. But then Anna Maria spoke, and her voice at once calmed me, though I couldn't see her. "Well, young man, you've had quite a day." With dreamlike fluidity, I somehow transitioned to a chair in the face-it tent, alone with Anna Maria, the table between us. I was no longer in pain. On the table stood a wide, shallow bowl containing an inch of water, and in the water floated a beautiful white flower, bigger than a cantaloupe, its petals radiant and as thick as wax. "The flower," said Anna Maria, "is the amaranth." She proceeded one by one to pluck the petals from the bloom, until she had completely deconstructed it. A couple of 100 pieces of the amaranth lay scattered on the table around the bowl. "You always said that you wanted to see the flower trick," she reminded me. "But it is not a trick. I have no trick to show you. This is only what is." "This is only what is," I said, still enigmatic. She smiled and shook her head. "No more enigma." The debris of petals on the table stirred, although no hand touched them. Before my eyes, the bloom reassembled and became again the exquisite flower that she'd taken apart. As the last petal reattached itself, the tiny bell around my neck began tinkling sweetly, the silver clapper beating against the silver strike and silver lip. "Who are you?" I asked.
"You know what an avatar is, young man."
"Yes, I know. It's the form in which a deity visits Earth."
"I'm no deity. I'm no avatar in that sense. But I have been for you, and others before you, something like an avatar. I am only human. Once, long ago, I gave birth to a daughter, and later she gave birth to a little boy, and I am now for eternity a universal mother, a mother to love those who, like you, were unloved by their mothers on Earth. You are, young man, as fine a son as any mother could wish to have, and you need not be afraid of what will happen now."
The silver bell rang one more time, and suddenly I felt as if I were the flower, being dismantled, as it had been, pieces of myself falling away, showering away into a terrible darkness, until nothing remained of me. Nothing remained, and yet I was aware in the utterly lightless void. Before me appeared a form in the void, and it was, of all things, a golden question mark. It might have been an inch high, or 1,000 miles from dot to upper curve. Because I had no body, I had no sense of perspective. The question mark remained before me, or above me, or below me, long enough that I began to wonder if I was supposed to respond to it somehow. As I considered what to say, the question mark morphed into a golden exclamation point, like the one on the cell phone that I'd been given by Edie Fisher. After a moment, the exclamation point exploded soundlessly into a rushing abundance of light. The black void vanished around me, and I found myself flying through a smooth blue realm of radiance with no detectable source, gliding as if on wings, though still I had no body. The blue gave way to the crystalline light of the Mojave, and suddenly I was standing in downtown Pico Mundo on a sun-drenched day. The jacaranda trees were in bloom, and the birds were singing, and the air smelled clean and sweet. I was dressed now in my customary attire, sneakers, blue jeans, and white t-shirt. No bandage wrapped my left hand, and I bore no wounds. The town lay in an unnatural quiet, the silence of cemeteries. No vehicles plied the streets. No pedestrians. No sign of a living soul. I felt that I must be alone, having returned to my hometown after all of humanity had been killed off, and a deep uneasiness overcame me. I started walking, not certain where I should go. Within half a block, I heard hurried footsteps, heels clicking against a sidewalk in the preternatural silence. I couldn't quite discern from which direction they approached. Uncertain who or what might be rushing toward me, I halted. A moment later, Lou Donatella turned the corner. He waved at me. He wasn't dressed either as a bear cub, or as he had been dressed when he burst into the funhouse to save me. Like me, Lou wore sneakers, blue jeans, and a white t-shirt, though on his shirt were the words, "Little is big." Still disoriented, I thought that I'd return to my role as a counselor for the lingering spirits who would not move on to the other side. Then Lou said, "Hey, dude!" If I could hear the dead, not just see them, I had to be dead as well. But like the amaranth, dead and not dead. Lou grabbed my hand and pumped it with both of his and said, "Big orientation meeting at the movie theater on the square this evening. Can't wait for it. See you there, pal." He hurried past me, engaged in some task I could not imagine, As I looked after him, he turned once and shook two fists in the air and laughed and said, "Isn't this great?" before he continued on his way. I watched him until he turned another corner, and gradually an understanding came to me. Or I wanted to believe that it was an understanding, a perception of truth, and not just a wild hope. At a run, fast as I could go, I headed toward the house in which Stormy had rented an apartment. In this Pico Mundo, I could run much faster than in the old, and without tiring. When eventually I turned a corner onto the street where she had lived, I found the sidewalk opposite her apartment house lined with people whom I'd known. All of them were people who had died and lingered, who had finally crossed over with my help. An old school teacher of mine. A high school friend who had died young. A young prostitute who had been shot to death at a place once called the Church of the Whispering Comet Topless Bar, Adult Bookstore, and Burger Heaven. There were dozens of them, scores, including Mr. Elvis Presley and Mr. Frank Sinatra. They were all dressed in sneakers and blue jeans and white t-shirts, both the men and women, but each of their outfits had a detail or two different from the others. This one wore his cuffs rolled, that one wore his sleeves rolled, this one sported an embroidered flower on her shirt. They started waving when they saw me, and I was so excited to see them that I almost dashed across the street to shake their hands and hug them. But of all the people I have loved, there was one for whom my love had been most pure, and I could not stop until I knew for sure that Gypsy Mummy's promise had been kept. I raced up the steps to the front door of the house, the one that featured a large oval of leaded glass, here as it did in the other Pico Mundo. She didn't wait for me to go inside and knock at her apartment, but flung open the door and came into my arms on the stoop. I lifted her off her feet and turned in a circle with her, astonished, amazed, in a state of bliss that I thought I would never know again. Stormy Llewellyn, in sneakers and blue jeans and a white t-shirt, with pink military-style epaulets sewn on the shoulders. Beautiful Stormy, whole and radiant and laughing down at me as I looked up into her face. She said, "What took you so long, griddle boy?" Before I could answer, she said, "Put me down, put me down. Come on, I have to show you." When I put her down, she took me by the hand and led me through the front door, into the house, along the hallway, through the door to her apartment. The place was as it had been in the other Pico Mundo. The old floor lamps with silk shades and beaded fringes. The Stickley-style chairs with the contrasting Victorian footstools. The Maxfield Parrish prints and the carnival glass vases. She talked excitedly all the way along the hall and into the apartment. "What did I tell you, odd one? Boot camp. And what did I say followed boot camp? A life in service. And what did I say that life in service would be? You said it would be a great adventure. Greater than all the adventure story writers in the history of the world could imagine. You said it would out-Tolkien Tolkien, and that after it comes the third and eternal life." "You did listen after all," she said. "Sometimes I wondered, griddle boy." She tore open a coat closet and took from it something like a crossbow, though it was a work of art, apparently made of silver and elegantly engraved from the stock to the stirrup. She said excitedly, "No guns here, Adi. No guns. I know you like no guns. They wouldn't be useful anyway." She handed me as well a quiver of short arrows that were tipped in silver. "No one here kills other people. That's all over and done with, all those terrible things. No more of that. No one eats animals, and the animals don't eat us. Wait till you talk to one, to the animals, I mean. It's the freakiest thing, but good freaky." From the closet, she took a second quiver of short arrows, these tipped in gold, and handed it to me. Bewildered, I said, "What is all this for?" "It's sort of like purgatory here, but not stuffy and sorrowful the way we always thought it would be. Atonement? Oh, yeah, we've got atonement to do, buddy. You better believe it. But the way we do it is nothing like you'd expect. The true and hidden nature of the world is as true here as it was back where we came from. But here, it's not hidden." I put the crossbow on a nearby armchair, the quivers with it, and said, "But what are we at war with?" "Oh, my adorable fry cook, Wait till you see them. They're the most hideous, terrifying creatures, and wickedly cunning. And there's ever so much that can go wrong. But what you always know now, what we all know here, is exactly what we're fighting for, and how right it is to fight for it. Now kiss me. I did. That is as much as I can say to those who are not yet here. But I suspect that my friend and mentor and surrogate father, Mr. Ozzie Boone, who loved me as if I were his own son, will in his inimitable way add a chapter 53. 53. Earlier in the night, the sky had pulsed with distant heat lightning along the southern horizon. We had no expectation of rain, however, and the weather report had said that the storm would never cross the county line. In the last hour of the day, I was ensconced in my custom-built armchair, which had been constructed to serve me without any fear whatsoever of collapse, until I attained the magnificent weight of 500 pounds, if I ever did. My cat, Terrible Chester, curled on the sofa, alternately snoozing and glaring at me with what might have been mistaken for contempt, though I knew it to be a kind of amused and gentle scorn. Oblivious of the Colt's heinous bombings in distant parts of Pico Mundo, I sipped Camus Cabernet Sauvignon, nibbled champagne cheese, and for the third time read Bleak House, which I found to be anything but bleak. I was on page 102 when precisely at 11:19 the meteorologists were proved wrong. Such a flash of lightning scorched the night and flared so brightly at every window that, had gravity not been a special challenge to me, I would have shot to my feet in alarm. Even as an immediate and equally bright second flash followed the first, an unprecedented crash of thunder shook the house from chimney top to foundation, vibrating in the window panes. The second peal outdid the first, and on the top of the side table next to my chair, my wine glass wobbled and almost tipped over. As a novelist, but also as a man who has never tried to extinguish the child in himself, I love spectacle. Abandoning wine and cheese and Mr. Dickens, I managed to ascend from the armchair with my usual strained dignity and made my way to the front door and then on to the porch. Never in my considerable experience had the sky been so crazed with stormlight. Great bolts beyond counting, crackling across the heavens in curious patterns, one bolt arcing to the next, revealing the clouds in such a way as to make it appear that they were in fact the crumbled and tumbling remains of some great and ancient stone city sliding down a mountainside to bury Pico Mundo in those ruins. When the rain came a moment later, it fell in torrents that the word cloudburst cannot begin to describe. Throughout the rainfall, the lightning did not cease, nor the thunder, until the entire spectacle ended in an instant. Stunned, I looked at my watch and saw that it was 11:22 to the second. The entire storm lasted precisely 3 minutes. An hour later, when I returned to the porch, the sky had entirely cleared, and an infinity of stars shone brightly. I found that abbreviated tempest remarkable. I do not often sleep well. Sleep seems to me to be a preview of death, and I do not like to be reminded of that coming attraction. At 1 o'clock in the morning, in the darkness of that dismal May, as I sat reading Bleak House, Wyatt and Carla Porter rang the doorbell and brought me news of the dear boy's death. I almost died myself to hear of it. I wanted to die, and for once not by eating myself into the grave. We held one another in silence for a moment. I am large enough to be hugged by two at once. When I could speak, I asked when Oddie had passed, but then I answered the question before they had a chance to respond.
It was at 11:19. And they confirmed my intuition. We sat around the kitchen table for a while, with coffee and memories, as we would often do in the days that followed. More than once, I would put the lie to my image as a hard-boiled writer of tough guy mysteries when I succumbed to choking grief. After Wyatt and Carla left, with night yet remaining and with the dawn unwelcome, I could not read Dickens, or taste the wine, or want the cheese. I went into my office intending to unlock the metal cabinet in which I kept the 7 manuscripts that Oddie had written, the accounts of his adventures, memoirs beginning with the story of the shooting at the Green Moon Mall and the death of Stormy. He'd written much in a little time, for he was as gifted with language and story as with his sixth sense, though because of his singular humility, he would never have taken such praise seriously. For obvious reasons, the 7 books were not to be published until his death. I didn't unlock the cabinet that night, for when I entered my office, I found my computer humming, though I'd switched it off hours before. The printer pumped out pages of what I could not imagine. Mystified, I took the stack already in the tray and found that in my hands I held his 8th and final manuscript. I'm certain you can imagine that my reaction included amazement and astonishment, but exceeded them. Amazement and astonishment express the momentary overwhelming of the mind by something beyond expectation. Amazement is an emotional response, astonishment an intellectual one. Wonder. Yes, in wonder, I waited for the manuscript to finish printing, and in wonder I carried it to the kitchen, where I brewed another pot of coffee and sat to read in another fortified chair. There was no title page, because he had never titled his books. He left that to me. Instead, the top sheet had this simple message. Sir, here is the last of it, a pile of strange pages. You will think that they can't have been written in the few hours since my death, but I do not live in time anymore. I can accomplish a lifetime of work in what would seem, from your side of the veil, to be mere minutes. I know that you will take my passing hard, because you're a kind man with a tender heart. But don't mourn for me. As you will learn from this story, all is well. The promise that mattered has been kept, and I have found work that, believe it or not, I enjoy even a great deal more than being a fry cook at the Pico Mundo Grill. I will miss you terribly until I see you. Odd Thomas.
Amazement, astonishment, wonder, and now awe. In awe, one's mind yields to something grand in character, formidable in power. I yielded without reservation. Terrible Chester was not a cat who found it necessary or even just pleasant to console or be consoled. But as I sat at the kitchen table, reading my beloved friend's manuscript, Chester sprang into my generous lap and curled there, and slept until I turned the final page. As with the other 7 memoirs, I have now changed a few of the names. For instance, those enemies of Edie Fisher, who do not already know her real name, should not be told it. And I concocted this nom de guerre to conceal her true identity in both this volume and in the one that came before it, deeply odd. I made no other alterations. For this final book, I never considered any title but Saint Odd. Oh, how he would dislike the saint part. He would want me to call it The Fry Cook Meets His End, or Odd as Ever, or perhaps Fumbling My Way to Eternity. But what other word so well fits a young man who would give his life to save a friend, or even an innocent stranger, and who, in giving it, would think he had not done enough. I have his ashes in a mortuary urn. I keep them on the mantel above the living room fireplace, where Stormy's ashes are in an urn beside his. I look up at them from time to time when I'm reading, and I smile to think that he would make jokes about the hard-boiled mystery writer being a sentimental basket case. I carry in my wallet the fortune-teller's card that he carried in his. You are destined to be together forever. And I dare to believe that it means not just Odd and Stormy, but all of us. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Saint Odd by Dean Koontz, performed by David Aaron Baker, directed by Lisa Kahn, performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.